it makes me think of this. I read an article last week, and the title of the article was "A Dark Consensus About Screens and Kids Begins to Emerge in Silicon Valley." And the subtitle of the article is a quote from it. This lady, she says, "I am convinced the devil lives in our phones." So, of course, the cell phone is the shape of a monolith, and that brings me to the Star Child. And this article is about kids being sucked into their phones and the devil living in there. So it fits with my sort of impression that how, you know, Lucifer works in this world, or what we call Lucifer, you know, how it works in the world, and it inspires people, you know, to do things in a mental realm, I guess. It's not necessarily bad, right? If it's balanced with all the other forces that make you up. But if it runs out of control and you put it up on a pedestal and put a crown on it, Stanley, it's going to get weird.
Well, I think like imagination and intellect are not inherently bad. On the contrary, they're inherently useful and necessary, but only if they're in the service of what the Christ represents, but Christ also, maybe Christ itself or himself, but the soul or the spirit. And like intellect, well, I think it's actually similar. Like there's a Christian idea of the intellect as the nous, the divine mind, what connects us to reality, which is obviously very different from what we think of as the intellect down here in the maze. And similar with imagination, as I read about in Seen and Not Seen, like the imagination can be a way to connect to the to reality beyond the five senses.
Yeah.
And tune into it. So then that's intuition, really. Like imagination that's really in service of the soul is a working intuition, as compared to the imagination that's in service of the intellect, which is in service of the state, Stanley, creating counterfeit images. You know, of reality that are counterintuitive. I don't know, like they, I suppose it's not necessarily so much that they're not accurate, but that they're not the thing. So like if you create a really compelling menu where the images are so good, a person ends up just gazing at the menu and feeling that they're having a, you know, surrogate experience of eating, and they forget to eat and they die.
Yeah. Well, this goes into all these groups that study the human mind, right? That end up working with the Hollywood guys, and they know that humans have all of these innate, beautiful mechanisms for us to work in the world, like you say, imagination, intellect, and all that. So they do their best to corrupt or distort or poison our natural mechanisms, because we're still going to use them like we did before, but now they're like a little rusty, or they don't move like they're supposed to, like trying to skate with an old skateboard or something, right? It just doesn't ride as smooth anymore because it's all rusty and corroded, and you haven't taken care of it.
Yeah. So to get back to what I think is the core of this, and this is a recent insight, but it's the way in which my understanding of Kubrick is dovetailing with my experiences with Dave O'Shaughnessy. This idea that we are discrete, separate individuals.
Yeah, how it's not necessarily true.
How it's not necessarily true. Like there's an aspect in which it can be true in the sense of a soul that's fully embodied is fully autonomous, and so has this, the freedom and the spontaneity and the joy of independent action, but somehow that is only possible through a full experience of not being separate, of being connected to the whole human meta-organism, the collective soul of humanity, which Christianity is the body of Christ. That's reality. So it's not individuality, it is autonomy. It's like free will within God's will or something like that in the theosophical sense. And that's only possible, yeah, if we, or as we dissolve or get free of the dissociated counterfeit illusion of the, you know, the defense identity that asserts its individuality, its independence in a false way.
Mm-hmm.
Not freedom within God, but freedom from God, let's say. And the Luciferian thing again. And so this is like, obviously this is so central to our world. I mean, our world runs obviously on that illusion. And therefore you could say it's also central to the hegemony of the ruling elite. Like they, at some, in some level they understand this and they don't want to participate in it. They want to have their individuation, which is a false kind of individuation, which is because you can't individuate away from the collective. I think you can only individuate into the collective, paradoxically.
Mm.
As in you recognize your affinity with everything and everyone, and you're not different or better or superior. You're just you're a different aspect or a different expression of something that's collective. While the false individuation is the negative identity that can only really experience autonomy, this surrogate autonomy, by controlling and dominating everything, including other people. And so it depends on creating a mass that can be herded and dominated and experiencing its individuality and its freedom and autonomy, like in contrast to that, like, again, a Luciferian thing. So then this is where I said, you know, the Kubrick, the illusion around Kubrick, it's a useful microcosm, because when we got away from the specifics, because you started to with look, and I've got a whole bunch more specifics about Kubrick, that he was never an autonomous agent. And he is a great case study, because actually if you trace back independent cinema, American cinema, you end up with Kubrick. He was the first independent. He was before Cassavetes.
Mm.
Cassavetes is considered the father of independent cinema.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
But Kubrick was making independent in quotes.
Yeah.
Before Cassavetes. So, but if you look back to Kubrick's roots, actually, yes, they were independent as compared to Don Siegel or Robert Aldrich or Sam Peckinpah. He wasn't working up his way up the system. But he had these other shadowy backers. He was doing fight documentaries, boxing documentaries. So
that, The Day of the Fight.
Yeah. Day of the Fight. So that's organized crime. That's mafia.
The Brotherhood of the Sea, which is like a sea navigation and a navy type thing.
Right. He was doing propaganda work.
Yeah. The Flying Padre, I think, is another one of those early films that Flying Padre is about a father or whatever who flies around South America. You heard about that one too?
I have, yes.
But yeah, a lot of his early movies are funded by this guy, James B. Harris, right? Who works for MGM.
We've got to go before that. Like James B. Harris was the beginning of, the sort of official Kubrick narrative.
Okay.
One with Paths of Glory, or The Killing, I guess. But before that, where you were just at, I'm just looking at the...
Oh, okay. So those first three little docs that he did.
Quite a period, I mean, but also the features. So let me just look at the timeline here and then make it easier. Okay, so as you said, the Look thing, that was obviously the turning point, that famous photo he took at Look, that of the old man, you know, after FDR died. Kubrick tells everyone it was a lucky shot, but actually he admitted to privately that he'd directed that old man.
So
that was a counter. That was an early example of a counterfeit in the true sense, as in the movies, not truly a counterfeit because it's not pretending to be real, but this was pretending to be an actual, you know, found snapshot. But
and it's his first one, right? His first famous picture. It's totally fake.
That's right. Well, it's not totally fake. It's a real.
Well, it's a real guy.
Contrived. It's contrived.
Yeah, he didn't picture the light in the moment. He set it at the light how he wanted it to be.
And he got the man to act, apparently. He got him to act sad, to look sad. So
yeah, and he got his promotion at the paper, I'm sure.
That is, as part of the mythology anyway, that was a turning point for Kubrick. Of course, it's worth questioning, you know, how much of this does get, written afterwards, because I think it's really important to create, essentially, even to create the narrative of the ascent of the superior man in a way that does look organic and a result of his own ingenuity, right, and his talent. That's totally central. But at the same time, you can, if you pick away at it, you can see, you know, the strings. So
yeah. Like Columbus discovered America, same thing. You just brush that off a little bit and it's like, oh yeah, sure.
Right. Of course, Columbus is a bad guy now. So that's
But was he?
All right. So anyway, so 1947, he was issued a pilot certificate. Early New York friends, Ruth Hubley, famous photographer Diane Arbus, who took to Saturday Night Charades parties in the village. What's that code for, I wonder?
And she killed herself, fun fact, in a bathtub.
So yeah, in the 50s, miscellaneous television and State Department trivia. Sorry if I seem to be pointing at you. I'm actually looking at a document now.
No.
Second documentary is about a New Mexican priest, Stad Muller. He made a documentary about the World Assembly of Youth. Initiative was to have its payoff in JFK's Peace Corps. Okay, so this is all propaganda stuff.
Now, yeah, exactly.
This is the turning point. 3 years before his first feature, which would have been Fear and Desire, I guess, was it?
Yeah, either that or like Killer's Kiss or...
I always get those two confused. No, it was Fear and Desire. He met Richard de Rochemont. Do you know about de Rochemont?
No, but if I can judge by the last name, it's old money, right?
Yeah, brother of Louis de Rochemont, the creator of the famous March of Time series. He was a Harvard graduate, documentary filmmaker associated with Charles de Gaulle during World War II. And he wrote for Henry Luce's Time magazine, which, as we know, was CIA's Operation Mockingbird key instrument.
Yeah, so right from a propaganda magazine to getting money from a propaganda Harvard guy.
Yeah.
So two strikes right off the bat, basically.
So yeah, de Rochemont, Richard de Rochemont, was responsible for France's rallying around de Gaulle and against the Vichy government. So obviously very highly placed kind of intelligence operative. Highly decorated with honors in the country of his French Huguenot family, Huguenot, how do you pronounce that? His brother, is the brother of Kubrick's first backer, this is, was trained by British intelligence in the early 1920s at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to pioneer naval photography and motion picture reconnaissance. Dwight Eisenhower personally recruited him for the position of Secretary of the Navy as World War II broke out. Right. So he also produced Animal Farm, funded by the CIA under Operation Market. So that's conclusive. He was a CIA asset, and his brother was Kubrick's first supporter. He funded Fear and Desire, which established Kubrick as, you know, this up and coming independent New York filmmaker. And Kubrick, he was Kubrick's benefactor, boss, and father figure. Kubrick once told his wife, Jane, you know, we're really Dick's children.
That was his first wife, Jane?
No, he said to de Rochemont's wife, wife, you know, we're really de Rochemont's children.
I see.
So there you have Kubrick acknowledging that the man who put him on the map, that was the man who put him on the map. He wasn't acknowledging that man was a, you know, propaganda agent for the intelligence community.
Well, it's easy to piece together that he gave Kubrick his big start there after the first bump at Look magazine. So he was just handed from intelligence agent to intelligence agent, like up the ladder. It seems sometimes.
That's what it looks like. And so then he made Fear and Desire, Killer's Kiss. And then his breakthrough film was The Killing. And
is it the one about the horse?
Yeah. That's the one about the whole
Red Rum, the horse, and all that.
Red Rum?
The horse's name is Red Rum.
Oh, right. Oh, God, yeah. I forgot that, of course.
Oh, no. Kubrick's self-referential sort of megalomaniac, that star. You can see the same shot in Flying Padre as in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, basically the same shot. Obviously, 2001 is in color and Flying Padre is black and white or whatever. But you can see that he had this... this stencil of how he was going to film a movie laid out from even before he got really, you know, more popular, I should say.
Well, again, you're attributing it all to one man and saying in the question.
Yeah, true. That's true. I should say that Kubrick movies, his documentaries look like his movies in that case, I should say. Like Flying Project has shots that, again, you'll see again further down the line in one of his color movies.
Right.
So the template has existed, it seems.
Yeah, well, that would fit with my developing theory that Kubrick was a front man for a larger operation, let's say.
Yeah, because he was just one of the most talented photographers, or because he was very malleable, right? But yeah, he was a great photographer. Like my ex-girlfriend was a photographer, so I like to think I can pick him. But I always thought that Kubrick was a really good, you know, photographer. His camera shots are good. And if they can get the best guy, why not hire him? It just makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Now, cinematography is something I wouldn't try and take away from Kubrick.
Never seemed to be that easy before, but I guess it was compared to now. Reach for anything a million years away, change the length of time. Or you go out of your mind. You go out of your mind. It's not so easy anymore for us all. So obvious now. They've not, so it's not so easy anymore. Don't be easily persuaded by anything. The one thing I know is no one's right, but oh, how they try. Lie awake at night and invite escape. Trace every make of mind, then all. It's not so easy anymore for us all to just ignore the sign. It seems so obvious now. They've not, so it's not so easy anymore.
Anyway, so just rounding off this timeline, as I said, The Killing was his breakthrough, and it was released May 1956 in June. The same year, Time magazine ran an article titled The New Pictures that stated, at 27, writer-director Stanley Kubrick in his third full-length picture has shown more audacity with dialogue and camera than Hollywood has since the obstreperous Orson Welles went riding out of town on an exhibitor's pole.
Wow. That was in Time magazine?
That was in Time magazine.
Which is in his little network now, right? So they can fund him and publish an article about how awesome he is in the magazine.
And what his biographer, one of his biographers, Lo De Bruto, describes this publicity coup as: the ever elusive King of Hollywood Hill scepter was now in Stanley Kubrick's hands. Now, of course, this is courtesy of Time Life and Operation Mockingbird. He doesn't say that. I mean, it might seem overstating to say that he was crowned the King of Hollywood at that point, except that Orson Welles is actually a kind of forerunner for Kubrick in that regard. Well, not in his career arc, obviously, because Orson Welles was thwarted. Despite, or partly because maybe of being thwarted, he was by that time considered, you know, Citizen Kane had been raised up. It's kind of ironic or paradoxical, isn't it? Because 56, I mean, that was only 15, 14 years after Citizen Kane. You can bet that Orson Welles was still trying to make movies, completely unable, or almost completely unable, to make the movies he wanted to. Mm. And meanwhile, Kubrick's being compared to Orson Welles and elevated to the kind of power that Orson Welles would never again have.
Yeah, that might have pissed him off. Yeah. but again, maybe Orson Welles wasn't the sexy young figure they were looking for. You know, they needed a certain type of dashing young man with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And Orson Welles might have been chubby by then, right? With the white beard starting to happen. So maybe Kubrick just fit what they were trying to sell better. So you set Welles on the back burner, you put Kubrick on the stove right up front.
Yeah, well, I don't think it had anything to do with Kubrick's physical attributes, however, because he was never going to be a poster boy. but it must have had something to do with some of his attributes and something to do with how Welles must have disappointed, because he did the War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938, and if that wasn't a psyop, I don't know what was.
Yeah, so Welles seems to be working for him.
At that point, then Citizen Kane, well, that was an expose, a dig at Randolph Hearst, and that supposedly destroyed Welles's career. Well, maybe Welles was being used, you know, for sort of internal politics in some way, and it did backfire, or maybe he was seen to be expendable already at that point, and let him destroy his own career. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but certainly after that, he was pretty much unable to work, right? Magnificent Ambersons was taken away from him. So something went on with Welles whereby he must have bit the hand that fed him in some way, I think.
Yeah.
So that would be the main quality that they don't want, right?
Yeah, exactly. They don't want the dog to fight back. They just want him to shoot the pictures that we want the people to see. But how long was Kubrick? I mean, did Kubrick ever fall off? Like, because he was the darling boy when 2001 came out, all the fanfare and the whole thing, and big red carpet. Like, he was the darling boy for a while, but then Kubrick goes into the Welles mode, right? He gets fat and he goes off to the back burner, or seemingly anyway.
Well, he never fell out of favor, though. I mean, the only career obstacle he really encountered that I could find was Napoleon. Like, he wanted to make Napoleon, and he had... It seems as though he had complete carte blanche as of 2001, A Space Odyssey. However he got it, and of course there's lots of room for theorizing around that, but if this is the other thing I didn't share with you, which is obviously central. I just put this in the seedling, but have you seen the document? You must have seen it, which is about recruiting Kubrick to the propaganda department of...
There's an actual letter from someone to someone saying that we should hire Stanley?
Yeah, there's an actual letter. I've got it here. George Stevens.
Hmm.
So you haven't seen this confidential doc? It's,
no, what's the clip?
U.S. Information Agency Memorandum for Eric Goldman, Special Consultant to the President to the White House.
What's the date?
June 4th, 1965.
Oh, so while he's starting to film 2001?
I think it's prior. I think that this is leading. Okay. So it's about recruiting filmmakers. First of all, they've recruited film critics to offer their estimates of the most important American filmmakers. Four men were named by all six critics: Elie Kazan, George Stevens, William Wyler, Fred Zinnemann. Stanley Kubrick was mentioned by four of the six critics. One of these was in the most promising category. And then there's Kramer, Hitchcock, and Billy Wilder. Also, John Huston is not viable because he's no longer an American citizen. Therefore, per our discussion, my office will proceed to contact Kazan, Stevens, Wilder, Zinnemann, and Kubrick. They will be asked what scenes they believe would best demonstrate their work. We'll ask for alternatives so we maintain latitude. I think an important factor here is that President Johnson has led the way and given the motion picture the recognition it had has previously lacked in American political life. It is therefore particularly important that the person who handles this part of the program be truly knowledgeable and articulate on the subject so that this recognition is clearly justified. Anyway, it's a confidential doc. It's clearly about recruiting a filmmaker or more than one filmmaker into some unknown confidential project that the US government is embarking upon, and Kubrick is in the most promising category, and right after that he starts work on 2001: A Space Odyssey. So I don't know the exact timeline.
Yeah, but it's somewhere around 64, 65, I think, at least when they start filming it, because it comes out in 68, I think.
Yeah, it came out in 68, so I was assuming it wouldn't have started before 66 even, but it was a big project.
Well, yeah, I don't know if it ran that long, but yeah. Well, like you say, that was his big one, right? The 2001, and then you have it tied in with NASA. So you have Kubrick setting maybe what space is, looks like, right? So Kubrick does this movie. This is how space looks, y'all. Don't worry about it. A year later, they got the moon landing and all that jazz.
Yeah.
But there's a weird side note here. I don't remember which book, but I remember Rudolf Steiner again. He says something about Lucifer and color vision. I don't remember how Steiner was connecting the two, but I think it's funny that 2001 is Kubrick's first color film, if you don't count that Seafarers documentary, which was in color.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the some of the interpretations of 2001 are it's all about Lucifer and imagination, intellect, or whatever. So it's funny that it's the first color film, and Steiner's got some rap about Lucifer being connected to color vision in the human, you know.
Oh.
It's sort of just random.
Okay, well, I do think that 2001 is the first first Kubrick film that is demonstrable as state propaganda. Like, it just...
Overtly, yeah.
It's overt. Yeah. It's only not recognized as that because propaganda for the space program is seen as benign, and it's not even seen as propaganda at all because we're so indoctrinated to believe that going into space is a great thing and wonderful thing that it's not even considered propaganda, and because it's very cunningly embedded in a spiritual narrative. Going into space is not just a metaphor but a means for spiritual realization.
Yeah, when it's probably maybe the opposite, right? I'm just thinking of that. Who's the French guy who's got the scientific knowledge is really just a means of social control? Foucault, Michel Foucault.
Oh, not that guy. He's very dodgy, but I mean, he did make some good points, unfortunately.
Yeah, I like that idea of how the scientific establishment is the ones to say, you know, how you should express your individuality within the greater thing. And this Foucault guy was like, well, basically scientific knowledge is social control, so maybe you don't trust these assholes. I mean, he was a weird guy, you know, but I just liked that little idea. And especially when you start having Hollywood working in tandem, right, with all these other areas, especially, you know, science and space and how film and science seem to be so connected, right? We get videos from the International Space Station. We get videos from the moon. We get pictures from our telescopes, right? But like, people can't even say what's right in front of their face. And if you look through a lens that lets you look out into the sky, aren't you just magnifying your error like a million times, whatever the lens is, you know?
Yeah, true.
So I always had that little weird thing about like Kubrick, somehow they were using his movies to one, make themselves laugh and like get their inside jokes, but two, how they were using it to guide, you know, all the victims of the modern age, like all the people that are alive now. Like nuclear weapons are real and they're very scary, so watch out. And they're, you know, because they're being controlled by crazies. Space is real and you can fly to the moon. This is what it looks like, you know. Whereas these things may not be the case, right? Like, I don't want to go all nukes are fake or flat earth, but nuclear weapons might not work like they show us in the movies, right? Space might not be a place you can drive a ship into and land on the moon. Like, but we think that they are because we've seen all these movies, right? All these images.
Speaking of images, did you deliberately place the Man on the Moon album there facing forward?
Did I, Jason? Yeah, but you see, I was doing it.
Intelligence, yeah.
Well, I was doing it to sort of do another microcosm of this whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I do own that record, and like, I have listened to it to laugh and look through the color books, but I did place it there to see if you'd notice it.
Could hardly not notice. This Kubrick would have been a lot more subtle.
Well, I know, but I didn't have all morning to set up the set. Like, when I did the Limit Alista thing with you guys, I did set the chess game up to the same game as in 2001. But I don't think anyone noticed that.
I guess not.
No, but that's like part of the why some, like, I try to take this stuff lightheartedly. Like, it's, you gotta try to make a joke out of it, I think, at the end of the day, or else you're gonna end up absolutely lost in that maze. You have to slowly, like Danny, right? You have to slowly back out of the fucking maze. It makes me think of this thing from Lethem's article yesterday. He's using the knitting analogy, right, the whole time? Because the title of the article is something about knitting boots for Cthulhu or whatever. Anyway, he says, knit one, purl two, repeat ad infinitum. Is that like a knitting? Is that how you knit?
I guess so.
Yeah, so anyway, it reminded me of one step forward, two steps back, right? Knit one, purl two. But one step forward, two steps back is actually easier if you just take one step back at a time. It's the same thing, right? Because one step forward, two steps back is just a step back. So if you just take one step back, it's a lot easier than going one forward and two back.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Possibly, it probably does to you.
Well, to me, it was just like if you find yourself thinking things are a certain way based on movies that somebody else made, whether it's the government or Stanley Kubrick or NASA, then you might just want to take one step back at a time until you can see the whole thing, because you're probably lost in the maze of images that they're beaming into your eyes.
Absolutely, yeah.
But again, I like the knitting thing from Lethem.
Yeah. Well, I do love that scene in The Shining. I do find it quite profound, the way that Danny escapes, because it's a symbolic for undoing the past, like going back in the past in order to undo it, which I think is central to that movie. And I do really like that movie. I think it has something special. And I have a theory about why that movie is exceptional in Kubrick's oeuvre, a new theory that just popped up recently. And I think it has to do with the source material, and that it was the only time, I think, that Kubrick slummed it, so to speak. He went into the ghettos, he went to pulp for his source, and there was something about the material that even Kubrick couldn't kill it, because Stephen King is so human. He's got such a human-centric kind of perspective. Say what you will about his writing skills, which I think are, you know, reasonable. I think he's all right. He definitely has or used to have, anyway, his finger on the pulse of just ordinary human.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's basically our neighbor. Like, you see him at the gas station in his jeans and his T-shirt. Yeah. Like, dirty, you know, his hair is not combed or anything. I know what you mean by, I mean, I hate his books, except for The Shining and the one about the time traveling car. But I know what you mean, how he has an everyday Americana sort of feel to his writing. And it's like, just his characters are annoying and not always well written, but they're very natural, like to a human being that you would meet at the gas station or at the thrift store or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and he himself comes across that way, or he did. I don't know where he's at now, but in his nonfiction stuff, he had a very ordinary humanness about him, and a very unpretentious, the opposite of pretentious. And it did make his book. Yeah, he wrote a gothic number like The Shining, and it's probably kind of silly in many ways with all the gothic stuff, but he grounded it in his own experience as a writer, his frustrations as a father and as an alcoholic and all the rest of it. And it is, you know, kind of oozing or bleeding with that human angst that is so absent from Kubrick's work. And I think is inseparable from the pulpiness of it somehow. And I like pulp, you know, there's something about pulp that I really like, and the movies that I really respond to tend to be movies that transcend their pulpness, like spaghetti westerns, say, like they have a very lowbrow aesthetic or a lowbrow kind of template, but they transcend it, they take it into something else, right? Whereas Kubrick, it always seemed like he started out with some very lofty, profound subject matter, whether it was nuclear destruction or pedophilia, you know, or space conquest or mind control, you know, or so on. He always wanted to, his movies were always designed as these grand statements on the human condition, nihilistic ones, by the way, right? That's a bad combination in and of itself, I find. But with The Shining, somehow he ended up doing this pulp gothic horror novel. And I think it actually, I think it got the better of him. And that's why he did his only really satisfying work. That's my theory anyway.
I know. I kind of like that. Stephen King, I guess when you say that Kubrick went slumming, right, when he picked the book for The Shining, like his other books were, you know, Anthony Burgess, right? He wrote A Clockwork Orange, and Burgess was like English, hung out with all the English spies in the fancy bars, right? He was sort of not an asset, but definitely friends.
He was an asset. I got the data, the intel on that. Yeah. His biographer has him as an asset.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I thought the NADSAT was so complex that there's no way he could have figured out that language in Clockwork Orange by himself. Like, yeah, he's a good writer, and Dead Man in Deptford is a clever book, but there's no way he figured out NADSAT by himself.
Right.
I mean, I guess he could have if he spoke Russian or he's, you know, had some ties to some Russian friends. But the language that the kids use in Clockwork Orange is, unless he worked on it for years before he put it into the book. Like an example I can give you, I don't know if you speak Russian, but there's a word in Russian called hasho, which is like very good. But in A Clockwork Orange, Alex says real horror show. You know what I'm saying? So the word in Alex's language is a real horror show. He's trying to say something's real good. And it's just a play on the Russian word хорошо, which is also really good, you know?
Right, right.
And it's just super complex. And when I read the book, I was like, how did Burgess fucking do this? This is insane, because I speak a little Russian, and I was just like floored by the complexity of this little book, which is simple. Clockwork Orange is like a 220-page book, but within it, there's this sort of made-up language that is more complex than the entire book itself.
Right.
And that always fucked me up with Burgess. I can't really explain it.
Well, according to his biographer, the book has code in it as well, specific code on specific pages that is actually, you know, designed to communicate intel to other agents.
Intel agents, isn't that something? And well, when you come back to Stephen King, when you compare Stephen King's really human sort of deal to Burgess's fucking code-breaking MI6 tobacco and tea in the bar sort of deal.
Yeah, and Clark as well.
Like, yeah, Arthur C. Clarke, right?
With all his affiliations. Thank you.
But Stephen King, I would say that, have you ever seen, Stephen King has a son. I don't know if you are aware, but he's a painter. So Stephen King's son is a painter. And if you look at his paintings, they're this classic trauma, mind control, fragmentation sort of deal of the, you know, the paintings are. And I don't know, you know, what it means or whatever, but it fits this whole thing of Stephen King was traumatized and he passed it on to his kid. Now the kid's traumatized and you have this trauma artifact, The Shining, being made into this movie that everybody sees. So yeah, it's warm and fuzzy and human, and maybe it's a decent book and it makes for Kubrick's warmest movie, but it's also like a really traumatic artifact from Stephen King's life that gets put up in the spotlight by Kubrick, and the trauma gets transmitted to everyone that watches.
Well, you know what King said about the movie. Did you hear that one?
He hated it, didn't he?
Yeah, but he also said, he said that he thinks he, Kubrick is trying to hurt people with the movie.
Ah, now see, now Steve Augustine would say Kubrick's trying to hurt the elites, right? But I would probably say that, yeah, Kubrick is trying to get you farther into that image maze, you know, that's been being created since you were born and looking at a television screen. Like Jack is chasing you even further into
right. Well, because I wonder now, it's making me wonder that, because I must have seen that movie 6, 8, 10 times, I don't know, but it was only the last 2 times that I've enjoyed it. Right. So what about all those times that I was trying to get it? What was it doing to me? You know? Because just because now I think it's his best movie, and therefore maybe it's got some transmission in it, maybe there's something of real value. Well, yeah, maybe. But at what, you know, what cost? It's like if somebody gives you some vitamins, you know, wrapped in a McDonald's burger. Well, yeah, you get the vitamin, but it doesn't necessarily counteract the fact you've just eaten a whole pile of shit, right? So.
Exactly. I know that The Shining is good at creating that, I don't want to say dis-ease, but the sense of unease, right? In a physical, not just a mental way, but the way that the movie's, the sound design and everything and the colors, it's very good at eliciting a physical response of unease in the viewer, I think. That may wear off after a lot of viewings, but I can remember the first few times I watched the movie, and my friends that I've watched it with who have never seen it, or it's one of their first times seeing the movie, they'll have a really physically uncomfortable reaction. Whereas I have like moved past that because I've seen it a billion times, that for some reason it no longer elicits any sort of tension in my body. It's only a mind sort of thing now.
Which is kind of troubling in and of itself, isn't it? Because,
yeah.
Because, I mean, they've done these studies about, and this, I read about this with mirror neurons, how when we watch something, you know, it goes to the retina and to the brain, and the brain interprets it as if it's really happening. It doesn't distinguish between staged and real, or, you know, recordings and actuality. I mean, I'm not saying this is a fact, but this is what I've read. And because of mirror neurons, it doesn't necessarily, or doesn't distinguish entirely between what we're seeing happening to someone else and what's actually happening to us, right? So this was the thing with the mirror neurons, where they found the monkeys with their brains wired up, not only would the neurons fire when they were given a peanut, but when they saw, or a banana, when they saw, you know, one of the staff members eating a banana, they fired up as if the monkey itself was eating the banana, that whole thing. So, you know, the brain's receiving imagery, and it's reacting to it, and it's signaling to the body that something is happening that isn't necessarily happening. So then how much does watching movies, you know, either for the first time or repeatedly, how much are we actually programming our body, or you know, putting information into our body that we're not necessarily even aware of, and we don't necessarily get out of our body afterwards? Like, it could just be building up over the years, you know, watching these movies and rewatching them. And this, I'd say this is an unknown territory, and it's
this is one of my most favorite interesting areas about the movies, is that, okay, well, let's say that I'm not trying to disparage Dave, but let's say that some of Dave O'Shaughnessy's stuff about energy and the physical vehicle, I don't know if he gets into invisible human vehicles, right? Like an astral or an ether body. My point is that there's so much we don't understand about one human life living in the world. How could we know what film is doing to us as we're still trying to figure out what we even are? You know what I mean? Mirror neurons is a good example. Like, okay, science says your brain is firing like you're doing it. Well, I mean, that seems like it has some pretty serious implications if you watch someone get tortured, get yelled at, or, you know, there's no difference between Gunny Sergeant Hartman yelling at the recruits in the beginning of Full Metal Jacket and him yelling right at you, you know what I mean, as the viewer. Yeah. And I think Kubrick plays on this all the time, where the thing happening in the scene is addressing the viewer directly. Like I said, I think the sergeant in the first half of Full Metal Jacket is supposed to be breaking down the viewer. Like, you're laughing at him yell at the Marines, right? Well, the joke is on you because you're the one with the mirror neurons getting yelled at, broken down by the guy. He does this sort of weird thing again in Eyes Wide Shut, where Bill is at the orgy. He's been found out. He's still got his mask on. He's in the center of the ring. The camera is panning around the outside of the group. And when the Red Cloak says, "You'll kindly remove your mask," the camera, let's see if I can do it. The camera is completely like this, you know, and it looks like, as the viewer, you're looking through the mask, you know, the black area on the screen. Mm-hmm. So it's obvious that, like you say, Stephen King said he's trying to hurt people. Well, yeah, like the viewer is the one getting hurt, like every individual viewer, because it's constructed to go right at them.
Into their unconscious, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, into their unconscious. Well, it's a mix, right? Just like Bill's dream scene. Some things in Kubrick movies go into your conscious mind, but a lot of it, most of it probably, goes right into your unconscious mind.
So what about how a movie like Eyes Wide Shut and even The Shining, because even this Augustine fellow acknowledges that there's two movies going on and one part of the surface movie is bad, right? There's stuff in there that's deliberately bad. So I would say that, and I think it's hard to separate with someone like Kubrick, amateur, who is just losing his ability to, you know, to recreate reality, and how much of it was deliberate. Mm-hmm. But in any case, when one is watching Eyes Wide Shut, and certainly the first time, because one hasn't been indoctrinated to believe that it's you know, something more than is just on the surface. The first time one is watching Eyes Wide Shut, there's this combination of confusion or distaste for the stilted dialogue, the artificial acting, whatever.
It's just a bad movie the first time you watch it.
It's a bad movie, right? But the subject matter, even overtly, but certainly covertly, we're discovering with all these hidden elements, is as dark and disturbing as possible. So I'm just wondering how that, like you're saying, your conscious mind is receiving one thing, which is what's going on the surface, and the unconscious, there's a deeper content that's going into the unconscious mind, which is deeply disturbing. And it's as though it creates a split whereby, or it reinforces a split whereby, there isn't a dialogue between your conscious mind and your unconscious mind. That's cognitive dissonance also. So you can't leaven the effects, if you see what I mean. Like, if your conscious mind can't dialogue with your unconscious mind, which is being terrorized, let's say, or disturbed, yep, or hurt, or you know, assaulted,
traumatized,
assaulted by very disturbing dark material, which the body recognizes, but it doesn't have the conscious mind to intervene to say, it's okay, you know, this is only a movie, so to speak. Yep. I mean, literally in this case, because the conscious mind's too busy going, what the fuck's going on? This is, you know, it's not really able to reconcile the levels, because they're not.
Well, I think this delivery method must have been studied before, right? To create a certain moving image that is capable of doing this, right? Of splitting the person that it's going into. Like, I don't know how they would study this, but you know, you could create a certain type of image that you'd be able to do this. You'd be able to address a person's conscious and slip everything else in, like a programming, right? Like when you install a application on your computer, a nice box comes up and you click yes, but there's all the code behind it that's getting installed on your computer, not just a little user interface that says install now.
Yeah.
The code that you don't see the code on the install yes or no screen, you just see the screen there.
Right. So that's the manufacturing consent and the suspending disbelief thing. You submit to the information, you let it in, you let the code in. And the thing that Kubrick's doing that people recognize is he's sabotaging the usual mechanics. He's the anti-Spielberg, because Spielberg does his propaganda in a way that is...
You would never think he's on your team.
Well, it's seamless. You get carried away by the story, and so you don't bother to notice the fact that you're being propagandized. And so that's conventional propaganda, right? Well, it's not that conventional, because people don't realize it's propaganda, but
it's just really slick, nice propaganda.
It's very sophisticated, but more or less conventional, what we think of as propaganda, which is a good story or a good package that's a delivery device for ideological, you know, distortions, right? But what Kubrick does, I think, is more sophisticated, because he creates a surface that is not convincing. It's as though, like, I'm just speculating here, but it's as though potentially it makes us even more vulnerable, because we're not paying attention to the story. Like, so it's as almost as though you have to dissociate in a Kubrick movie, because they're not allowing you to be involved, you know, at a surface level. So like, I mean, when I first saw Eyes Wide Shut, I sat through the whole thing only to see how bad it was, because within 5 minutes I was like, I would have walked out, but it was so bad that I was fascinated. And it being Kubrick, if it hadn't been Kubrick, I would have walked out. But it being Kubrick and being really apparently bad, I just had to see how bad it was going to get, and if it was going to. So I was transfixed, but I wouldn't have been sitting there for 2 hours plus involved in the story. I'd have been sitting there kind of dissociating, because I'd been thinking the whole time, what's he doing? This is terrible. Oh my God, look at that. Oh, what am I? But at the same time, as I say, I was physically taking in all of the imagery.
Yeah, all the colors, all the shapes, all the lines. Yeah.
So I just wonder if that does make us more vulnerable in some way.
Yeah, like the Kubrick puzzle, almost part of its purpose is something about the way that it's structured, the actual narrative versus whatever the sub narrative, that like two waves crossing in a weird way on a soundboard or whatever. Like, I mean, maybe this works with like certain paintings like Dali or like Rembrandt, or like maybe this mechanism works with the still image, but.
People who defend Kubrick say that, well, he's showing that his films are propaganda. He's letting you know that, or he's not allowing you to get sucked into the story. So he's showing you that this is a movie, and so on. Right? They talk about all of this as proof that it's, you know, it's a positive, and it's you know, it's what makes Kubrick exceptional in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, obviously, I don't have to say, but I'm not convinced, but I haven't fully been able to understand, you know, how this could be a more sophisticated level of brainwashing. But when you mentioned painting, I was thinking about, you know, how the Nazis felt about Expressionism, that it was...
Yeah, it was not pure, right? So Kandinsky paintings must be burnt and all that kind of thing.
Because it was increasing decadence within society. And of course.
Yeah, right. As they.
We're not going to start the Nazis as smart guys who knew what was going on. But the CIA did put a lot of money into creating abstract experience.
Yeah, Pollock, right? That was the guy, the main guy. Yeah,
yeah, Pollock was the main man, yeah. And ostensibly that was to communicate a sort of to the Soviet Union, but also to Americans, that look how free we are as compared to the Soviet Union, because we've got these crazy, wacky artists. But, you know, the CIA, things are never that simple and never that superficial. There's always going to be different layers. So what if a deeper layer was this understanding that if you present to people abstract images that they can't have any feelings about and tell them that this is art, and so they stand there thinking, this is just shit, my five-year-old could do this, or I'm feeling in their body a dissonance, because they're deliberately created to be dissonant, but their superego is being programmed to say, no, don't think that, and don't feel that way, don't trust your visceral reaction or your logical thought, because this is art, so you have to adapt your aesthetic, or your not even aesthetic, but your physiological and your psychological responses to make them conform to the dominant cultural narrative that's being introduced, which is, this is great art. That would be decadence inducing. You would, your connection to your own felt visceral sense of what's true would be being eroded.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Soviets had a guy like this, they kicked out, Kandinsky, right? He did the circles and all the little... So they had their painters, but they kicked out. So he wasn't as shitty as Pollock. Like, I kind of like Kandinsky's thing. It's like a little cartoons. Mm-hmm. But again, if you're trying to build a world with like beautiful art and ideals and shit, that could be like bettering the world, right? So if you're the culture creators, you have to hold up shitty art for people to mimic and say, this is art. This is what a great artist is, when he's just basically throwing paints on a canvas on the ground. Like, it's nowhere near like a Raphael painting that you can sit in front of and like tears come out of your face, right? It's not on the same level.
Well, I think the idea of Raphael as well was to increase our sensitivity to beauty, so that we wouldn't just gaze at the painting, we'd look at the painting and then we'd see the world with new eyes, because the painting does represent the world.
Whereas Pollock, it's not.
Yeah.
Even a forest floor full of mud and old leaves has more like harmony and work to it than a Pollock painting.
Everything does. Back to the counter.
But that's the conspiracy, right? They hold up the shitty artists to make the culture shitty so they can rule the shitty culture.
So then this weirdly suggests that to create, because I felt that we didn't quite get to this creation of the counterfeit simulation, how that works. It suggests to me that to create a counterfeit, you have to create something that resembles the real thing in a way that would trick people, but is actually inherently opposed to it, is as far removed from it as possible. Because if you think about, you know, the implicate order, like you're saying, shit that leaves in the forest, everything has a natural organic, you know, it's an expression of this inherent sentience or the divine in existence. So that would include even Jackson Pollock, you know, it would include everything. Yeah. So then it's like you've got to push against that as much as you can, like using, I was going to say artificial intelligence, but the intelligence of the ego, which is a kind of insentient intelligence, because it's trauma based, it's like defended and protected from life. So you've got to assert that as much as possible to override this inherent quality that we have, which is to embody and represent nature. So then, I mean, I see that in Clockwork Orange. Like, that movie seems to me like ugly in so many different ways. Like the lighting, the staging, the acting, the costumes, everything about it is ugly. I can't believe that people admire that movie. Even, it baffles me more even than Eyes Wide Shut, which is more obviously bad. But Clockwork Orange is more obviously ugly.
Yeah, I would say like dirty. Clockwork Orange to me is the dirtiest movie that he ever made. He uses like a fisheye lens on a scene that doesn't really want it, and you get this weird distortion of like one of the detective's arms, and it is, like you say, a really ugly, dirty movie. But again, I think it's supposed to be that way. You're supposed to feel gross after watching that movie.
They say it's a masterpiece because it makes me feel gross. They say it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, but I mean, most people, like most people went out and voted today, you know, like just because most people think Clockwork Orange is a good movie or this or that a masterpiece doesn't mean it's not also a disgusting vehicle of, you know.
Okay, so then you're agreeing with what I was trying to say about expressionist art is meant to affect us physically in this visceral repulsion, with visceral repulsion, mm-hmm. but to fortify or program the part of us that will override our visceral responses by saying, no, this is the work of Stanley Kubrick, who's a genius, based on the work of Antonin Burgess, who's a genius, yeah. This is a work of genius, this is a work of genius.
Yeah.
And it couldn't possibly be endorsing violence because it's a work of genius, exactly. It's a work of genius, so it must be anti-violence. So it's so sophisticated, yeah. And ironic, I can't even understand it. So it really must be a work, yeah. of genius.
This couldn't possibly be MK Ultra because it's about MK Ultra. Yeah. It reminds me, I was in Portugal walking through an art gallery with this girl. She was fancy artist type. And as we were leaving, there was a 20-foot tall, like, garden spade in the ground, you know? It was art, I guess. So I'm walking out, I'm like, oh, what's this? She's just like, well, this is postmodern art, you know? And it was just a giant toy gardening tool in the sand. And I was trying to, like, wrap my head around, because she had a really nice education at a fancy school in Russia, and I'm like, you know, sound guy from the sticks in the United States. So I was trying to be like, to her, how is this art? And she was like, well, this is considered art, don't worry about it. So it was sort of that, like,
because that's the best she had.
Well, I mean, there was other stuff there, but I mean, she had a whole explanation about you know, postmodernism and what she learned about it in school and blah blah blah. But it was a good example of how, like, me, maybe not the most fancy, high-cultured person, would see a piece of postmodern art and be like, well, this is just crap. Like, I would never tell myself or try to convince myself that this is art. This is an oversized garden shovel that's too big to dig any garden. Like, this is stupid. But she had a nice education, and she had convinced herself that this is a piece of art and postmodern at that, and blah, blah, blah. So it was just a weird thing that you made me think of there.
So did you get in an argument about it?
Oh, I do not argue with Russian girls, Jason. You never win.
Did you play along?
I didn't play
along. I see what you mean.
Yeah, I did play along, but I said, I mean, it's interesting that I guess she's, what my definition was, she's like, oh no, that's absurdism. You know, she had another art word for what I thought this was. And she's like, well, that's called absurdism when things don't have any connection to mythology or blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you guys just make all this stuff up in college, right? And parrot it to people when you walk around looking at art.
Well, that sounds like the beginnings of an argument, potentially.
No, like I said, we were on vacation. Do not argue on vacation. But again, it was, country bumpkin type that I am. Like, I didn't know what postmodern art was. Like, I knew Jackson Pollock and CIA and all that stuff from, you know, conspiracy research or reading history books. But I'd never tried to convince myself through education that a giant garden tool stuck in the sand outside of the building that housed other paintings was ever art. Like, it never, that part of me, super ego or whatever, he's not willing to admit that postmodern stuff is art. Because it just doesn't have any, it doesn't resonate in my body. You know, it's a total mind exercise. And I'm not too keen on total mind exercises.
I hear a voice that's not my own, that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening.
That's the ending of my conversation with Mike B and of this podcast. I would like to thank very much those who have donated kindly to this enterprise. I think you know who you are. I hope you don't mind me not naming you. Well, just feel like I'm overworked right now, and it's one more thing that I can get away with not doing. But your donations are very much appreciated. They do keep the boat afloat, so to speak. Don't have a podcast as yet for next week, but I do have some things lined up, so do tune in at the usual time. That's next Wednesday. And subscribe to the website, blog, and podcast, or donate, or both, or comment, or all three, if you'd like to let me feel your presence out there. Also, if you'd like a consultation, liminal lifestyle, so on and so forth, first encounter is entirely free of charge. Contact me at jason with a u at protonmail www.thebrainwashed.com.
Everyone else, I keep hearing everyone else. I won't listen anymore. I won't listen anymore. These words, these words are yours. These words. When you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only one voice. These words.